You are listening to Blackburn Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. And tonight's episode is Welcome to the Twilight Construction Zone. And this is episode 82. And tonight we're going to look at the history of the Twilight Zone franchise, and especially the works of Rod Serling. And if you'd like to join us in the chat room, you can come out to bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. That's bb9tradingpost.chitango.com. And we've got quite the crew out there now. I see Mr. Detox the Kool-Aid has joined us. Miss Mer Bailey has joined us. And several more Anons, so welcome. Beulah Man has joined us. Briser One has joined us, so welcome all. And when you think about the Twilight Zone and just, you know, what does that term mean other than a TV series? And so breaking it down, just Twilight. Twilight is one of those interesting concepts because it can mean both the light at the end of the day after the sun has gone down, but it's not dark yet, or it can mean in the morning before the sun comes up, but yet it's not dark anymore. So it's that, you know, two different ends of a spectrum, if you will. When you think about twilight, it's that, you know, you don't have direct sunlight, you don't have direct moonlight. It's not completely dark, it's not completely daylight yet. You're in some transitional phase. And we talk about transition a lot on The Breakfast Club, especially going back to the esoteric terms of the cardinal, the fixed, and the mutable. And this is represented by the red, white, and black colors that we see in traditional esoteric literature, where the red is the cardinal, the beginning of something, the growth period, and then the fixed is that stabilization period where you basically have reached your plateau and everything's stable. And then you have your mutable phase, and that's when the old system is falling apart. And as the old system falls apart, it is, by definition, replaced with a new system. And as we go through our history model of the Great Year, we talk about how we moved from the Ice Age to what we call the Golden Era, and then the Silver Era, which is T4, T3, the Copper Era, T2, the Iron Era, and then T1, the present, the Light Era, where we are now. And in each one of those eras, you see this beginning of a system, that system basically reaching its zenith, and then it begins to fall apart. There's a period of flux, if you will, or disruption, and then it's taken over by a new system. And so, for example, T3, those matriarchal city-states and the fertility cult temples and things like that gave way to the patriarchal systems of first law in stone, and then finally, you know, law written on paper or soft materials, you know, the idea of a changing law. And so those kind of transitions. And so now we're in a transition moving from the last part of T2, which is the Piscean Age, into the first part of T1, the present. And this is now the Aquarian Age with the symbols of the Aquarius, the, you know, water bearer, and then the esoteric symbol of Leo. You know, and so the other aspect of Twilight the terminal period, especially after full development or success, a state of uncertainty, vagueness, or gloom, of pertaining to or resembling twilight, dim, obscure, and then we think of twilight zone, and I find it interesting that there is both, we'll just give you this definition. Twilight zone is an ill-defined area between two distinct conditions, categories, etc., an indefinite boundary. So an ill-defined area between two distinct conditions, categories, etc., an indefinite boundary. And I thought, what an interesting way to describe this world Zionist globalist movement of the, you know, the great work, and contrasting it with the great experiment of where European Western civilization should be, and that these two are at odds. And then looking at the military term twilight zone, and when you look at modern warfare, we talk a lot about first generation, second generation, third generation, fourth generation, fifth generation warfare, that especially once we get into fourth generation warfare, the military term twilight zone refers to that ambiguity of morality and war. And you used to, in Western civilization, you had clear-cut rules of engagement. You had clear-cut targets that were acceptable and not acceptable. Soldiers fought soldiers. Military men fought military men, and civilians, for the most part, were left alone in European warfare. Now, tribal warfare is different, different spectrums from just you scuffle and fuss until somebody gets hurt, then everybody backs off, up through one side completely annihilates the other side down to the last man, woman, and child. And that was one of the problems with the North American native, well, I won't say native because they came after the Clovis people, but the people that were here when the Europeans showed up in the, you know, 1492 on plus, everything was fine until resources got low, people were fighting over resource, or some taboo was broken. And then we, the gentle, noble savages, as you know, people like Franklin described them, you saw that total chimp out mode and saw that what they defined as war, and that there were no war councils. It was, you know, once it comes to fighting, it was all or nothing kind of thing, where they would just go in and kill and destroy everything. And there was no compromise until that bloodlust was calmed down. And this is what we're seeing a lot in South Africa, which is these chimp outs of, you know, total barbarism, just savagery, attacks on these white farmers, especially in South Africa. This is what we're seeing more and more in the United States, of just these savage attacks. And so the twilight zone is a military term for the ambiguity of where is the line in warfare, what is acceptable. So now, as we always start, I always say, whether you like it or not, every person on this planet is at war right now. We have a huge transition between nationalists and globalists, the great experiment, the great work. And I go back to 70 AD when Rome and the Jews were fighting and the Jews lost and Jerusalem was destroyed, was leveled, the ground was salted, and this is the beginning of the diaspora of those Jews. Now, what these modern Jews are, that's another story when we get into the whole Khazarian thing, etc., and, you know, what they are. But, you know, what I want you to understand is that war never ended in the mind of the Jews. The Jews have been obsessed on reclaiming Jerusalem ever since 70 AD by any means necessary. Now, we used to think that they had been thrown out of 109 countries over 200 times, and now people are starting to do even more research, and it's looking to be more like 395 times they've been thrown out, because they keep playing the same games, they get discovered, and they get thrown out. But as people like Mr. Dennis Fecho point out, that because of this throwing them out, they just go somewhere else and set up shop, and nobody really addressed the Jewish question or the Jewish problem. Now we're not in a position to merely throw them out of our country. That they have too much power for that to happen, as things are right now. But, you know, we are looking at this very well-financed, very well-organized group of people that have been looking towards reclaiming Jerusalem and rebuilding Greater Israel and punishing all of those horrible Europeans, those horrible white people that were so mean to them during the diaspora and that destroyed, you know, Jerusalem, etc. So Rome must pay. Europeans must pay. You know, all the white people are responsible for the sins of the fathers in the Jewish mind. Now, when we look at, you know, trying to define the Jewish mindset and this modern Maccabee zealotry that we're seeing unfold, I always go back to, you know, you had this religion, but that religion was shaken by modern science. And I always go back to Judaism is, by axiomatic definition, a master-slave system. It's a geocentric system. It's that seven-light menorah symbolized those seven great lights, free-willed planets of the ancient system, you know, the model of the heavens in the ancient world, where you had the seven free-willing planets, and that was represented by the seven candlestick menorah, the temple menorah. Well, in 1543, when Copernicus did on revolutions of heavenly spheres, that shook that geocentric model. And, you know, the world did a shift to a heliocentric model where, you know, okay, the heavens don't rotate around the earth. The earth is a planet that's rotating around the sun. And so that was the shaking of the foundation. But when in 1781, when William Herschel discovered Uranus, as the most Europeans say, Uranus, as the Americans say, you know, this was the eighth planet. That completely shook the religion of Judaism to its core. And so you saw this manifest in both the atheism of the modern Zionist, but also in things like when Nietzsche wrote Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and that God is dead type of mentality that swept into this movement. So you've got this people that are organized, well-knit, well-connected, they're international, they're distributed. They have one goal, which is to reestablish Israel and Jerusalem as the world capital, but their religion is bankrupt. So they just say, fine, we will be the gods of this planet. You know, God is dead, we'll be the gods. And so that's the Zionist mindset, that these people are just moving forward as their own deity. The Jewish people as a system shall become God. And so when we see that twilight of moving from the Piscean Age into the Aquarian Age, the Jews were quick to grab the symbols of the Aquarian Age, the two rivers of the Aquarius sign, and they say that represents the Nile and the Euphrates, and then that Star of David, or the hexagram, it's not a Star of David, they just say it is, but that hexagram in the original flag, of course, had the Leo lion, the esoteric. And so this idea of transitioning from the Piscean Age of Christianity with the two fishes and the Virgin as the esoteric, you know, the Blessed Mother Mary as the symbol, and Jesus and the two, the Piscean fish is that symbol of Christianity, and that one of their planks and their platform is to destroy Christianity, and how much they hate Jesus Christ. And they talk about it in the Talmud, that because of his transgression, he's boiling in a pot of excrement for all eternity in hell. And, you know, the horrible things they say against the Blessed Virgin Mary, etc. But, you know, this transition, this twilight between these two ages is very fundamental to the Zionist movement, the World Zionist Movement. And so even as early as 1716, we were seeing the beginnings of this in these secret organizations that the Jews were forming. For example, the Dome was formed with crypto-Jews in 1716 in Turkey and Greece, and they would become very significant in the overthrow of the Ottoman Empire and the coup d'etat that happened with the Young Turks and everything. So this idea of the secret society, and then to create secret societies like the Freemasons or the Templars for the Gentiles so they could control them. So when we look at, you know, them coming together to plan this out, some of the key things we talk about is, you know, 1848, the Communist Manifesto was published by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. And like we said, then 1883 to 91, Nietzsche was publishing Thus Spoke Zarathustra with God is Dead. Then 1896, you know, we talk about Theodore Herzl writes The Jewish State. 1897, the First World Zionist Congress. 1899, Sigmund Freud publishes The Interpretation of Dreams. And so that idea of Freud coming in with this psychoanalyst method of really coming up with a delivery system to push fear and sex on Western culture. And when you look at Freud's model, it basically all reduces down to fear imagery and erotic imagery, sexual imagery. And so Freud's symbolism, you can tell it had a big influence on Rod Serling's writing, that he definitely came out of that whole Jewish psychology, psychoanalyst symbolism, Oedipal complex type systems, and that comes out throughout his writing, and that the idea of putting people into a receptive state with either sexual imagery or fear imagery so that you can program them to accept the abnormal, to make it the new normal. And so when you look at all the Twilight Zone episodes, there's always this fear element, but there is also a sexual theme running throughout so many of Serling's writings. And so that really came into play. Not just Serling, but so many of those Hollywood screenwriters, you know, were just basically taking Freud's work and writing stories around that model. Now, in 1907, the Young Turks met in Paris. 1902, the Russian Zionist Congress met. Then Of course, you know, so here after that 1897 big World Zionist Congress, you saw all these Jews going back to their host countries and saying, okay, how are we going to implement this great work locally? And so, like I said, you know, the 1902, the Russian Zionist Congress held in September of 1902, right around Yom Kippur and everything. And it was in 1903 that the Protocols of the Elder of Zion was leaked. So that document was about, you know, how the nuts and bolts of how they're going to undermine all of these Gentile cultures to bring in their New World Order. Now, here in the United States, 1913, the Federal Reserve and the ADL are formed. Talk about a power grab. They seized our ability to control our money, and they put in this fifth column whack-a-goyim system that, you know, basically sets Jews up to be the innocent victims, and anybody who goes against the Jews had the entire tribe come after them. That was what the ADL did. They basically monitored, and anytime somebody would report a problem, they would bring in the rest of the troops, and, you know, they would bring in Mossad or organized crime or whatever to shut the people down. And, you know, so many of the ex-Mossad officers, you know, talk about this. This is how we did the model, you know, it's right out of people like Saul Alinsky's playbook. You know, this is our by any means necessary intransigence smack you down with the full weight of the Jewish people behind us. And one of the Americans, of course, who saw what was going on and tried to warn the world about it was Mr. Henry Ford. And so in the 1920s, and then the 1908, the Young Turks did their military coup and seized control of what's now Turkey. So, you know, we see that they had planted their people all over every place they had a stronghold. And they were coordinating this new type of warfare, this distributed fourth generation warfare against their host countries. And so when you break it down, you could see they're doing the same thing with a few variants everywhere from the Ukraine, Russia, Turkey, the United States, Germany, you know, the UK, etc. Now, Henry Ford, and like I said, in the 1920s, first published over 500,000 copies of the protocols and sent them out as a warning. You know, he was very convinced that this was real, like I am now. I used to scoff thinking it was an anti-Semitic canard, but it just follows that this, you know, was the procedure manual. They got together, they came up with a plan. You go from the big picture to the nuts and bolts in any design, any military campaign. It goes from, you know, what are your big objectives? How are you going to carry them off? Who's going to do what? And so that's what the protocols were. And so he then followed that up with The International Jew in a four-volume series. And the first one was The International Jew, the World's Foremost Problem. Then in 1921, Volume 2 was Jewish Activities in the United States. Volume 3 was Jewish Influence in American Life. In 1922, Aspects of Jewish Power in the United States was Volume 4. So, you know, those titles alone tell you that he's describing an organized adversary that has its intent on destroying the United States, the great experiment of self-rule. And you can see how much the Jews hate Henry Ford. Then, you know, this was, you know, on the heels of the Young Turks carrying out the Armenian Genocide in 1915, 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution, how many million, tens of millions, you know, hundreds of millions. And after all these coups, etc., you saw them all working together, especially the Russian Bolsheviks helping the Young Turks and supplying the Young Turks. also, you know, in the world we're looking at, you know, 1914 to 1918, World War I occurring, and we now know that that was complete Jewish interest for the Balfour Declaration, that, you know, we're going to tear down the Ottoman Empire and establish a beachhead in Palestine, and we're going to use the British to carry this out. And so World War I was just the next step in this procedure. And then in 1923, we talk about, you know, the Kalergi plan of using immigration to eliminate and displace Europeans and white people in North America and Europe, etc. And so that was 1923 that the Pan-Europa was written by Kalergi. So then, of course, in 1932 to 33, we had the Ukrainian Holodomor, and that was over 10 million non-Jews killed. Then in 1933, Judea declared war on Germany during Purim of 1933. And, of course, 1936, you have the Spanish Civil War. Now, what's interesting about the so-called Spanish Civil War is the more we go back and look at that, the more parallels we see between that situation and what we're seeing in modern Syria, where it was not a civil war. This was outside influence trying to gain power in Spain. And what I found fascinating in this research the last few shows is how many of those original writers of the so-called modern literature movement went and fought with the communists in Spain. So how many Jews were fighting in all of these proxy wars, you know, in Jewish interests and basing out of the United States? And so, you know, you had all of this Jewish interest going around the world to start these wars, assassinate, you know, key political leaders, using just raw terror to achieve military ends. And it was a global thing, and that the common factor was always Jewish interests. But they never told you that in school, because by the time we came through school, our public education system had been completely controlled by the Zionists and the Jews. So, of course, you know, 1939 to 45, World War II starts. And this is when you start seeing that Jewish influence in both, you know, the United States, UK, France, etc., working together to defeat Germany. And one of the things that's interesting is so many of these Jews fought in World War II, like Rod Serling. And so people were noticing this Jewish power. And so in 1938 in the United States, the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, started doing investigations of what they considered to be un-American activity. And you can imagine the response from the Jews. What is it? The Jew screams out in pain as he strikes you. So we are still told that, you know, everybody who was on the House Un-American Activities Committee was an evil Nazi, that was an anti-Semite, etc., when in reality it was these very clever Gentiles that were seeing what was going on, and they were trying to do something about it, but they were dealing with an adversary that was playing by a set of rules very different than what they were used to playing. And this is why it's so important to understand war game theory and to see how different adversaries fight. And we're now recognizing the Jewish method of warfare. And I think, you know, it's been a great awakening, and that's one of the big things about the internet. Is that so many people are waking up to this adversary and their tactics, whereas in the 1930s, in the 20s, it was just a few people that were seeing this, and they were easily discredited and shut up. at various levels. And, you know, and like I said, they continue to be beaten down. They, you know, beating down those dead white guys. It's like you cannot watch any Hollywood television without somebody making a jab at Henry Ford or Joe McCarthy. They're just, you know, the go-to, or General MacArthur, for example, or Patton. They just, anybody who's ever stood up against the Jews is going to be beaten on forever, just like Haman or the Hitler. You know, just, they never forgive, they never forget, and it's never enough. And so that's just the mindset. In 1947, the House Un-American Activities held 9 days of hearings on what was known as the Hollywood 10. Now, I put some of the propaganda around this where you can really see the dishonesty and the deceit and the acting coming across from the so-called Hollywood 10 as they're playing the eternal innocent victim, and they're trying to claim the moral high ground. And all of them are Jewish directors and screenwriters, etc. And instead of answering the questions that are you interjecting communist propaganda into your product, yes or no, they, instead of answering it, say, you don't have a right to ask me that. And so this goes back to the, like, the Saul Alinsky model of make your enemy live up to their own book of rules. And so here you saw all these subversive Jews that knew exactly what they were doing. They had no bones about it. They hated Western civilization. They hate white people. They wanted to destroy everything, demoralize everything, so that they can take over. And they write about this, they brag about this, but when they're on the stand, they wrap themselves in the Constitution and claim that they had the First Amendment rights not to answer it, and they ended up getting cited for contempt of Congress. And of course, the Jewish media painted the Congressional Committee as the bad guys, that this, oh, this is this totalitarian government cracking down on these poor creative people that are just being artists and want freedom of expression, when they were using psychological warfare per their game book. This was intentional demoralization that they were imposing on the Americans to rot it from the inside, and when they got caught, they claimed to be the victims. And to this day, Hollywood always talks about the Hollywood blacklist like, oh, this was, you know, such persecution and assault on freedom of speech. And I get so angry when I hear groups like the ADL and AIPAC and the Southern Poverty Law Center shutting down and demanding things get shut down time after time, when at the same time they say they have free speech to do anything they want. And that, to me, just really sums up the mindset of people like Rod Serling. He was always out there saying, you know, you have no right to censor me. I can't be censored. I'm an artist. I have the freedom of speech guaranteed by the Constitution. But the second anybody said anything contrary to what he believed, he would shut them down. And this is, like I said, Harlan Ellison's the same way. Try to talk, you know, the World War II truth or the revisionism of the Holocaust with somebody with that mindset and say that you have the right to publish your findings on the Holocaust. And people that, you know, like the Ernst Zundels out there, they're the first ones that are saying those people should be taken out and shot. They have no right to persecute the Jewish people like that and spread lies, etc. But when it's them, no one has the right to censor them. And that was, you know, what kind of world Rod Serling was born into. And so that one thing, you had the Jewish supremacist model, the anti-Western civilization model, this idea of the intellectual elite Jew that was just smarter than everybody else and everyone else was stupid. And fighting for a very un-American agenda. So when you look at, you know, Rod Serling, he was born in 1924. And they always say he was an American screenwriter, playwright, television producer, narrator. And it's like, no, he was a Jew living in America. He was born in Syracuse, New York, to a Jewish family, the second of two sons, born to Esther and Samuel Lawrence Serling. And he, when he was in high school, he was totally for the war. He was a big World War II proponent. He was a big activist. He was very much anti-German. And when he finally began his military career in 1943, and he was actually decorated. So he received a Bronze Star, a Purple Heart, Army Good Conduct Medal, World War II Victory Medal, Army of Occupation Medal, Philippine Liberation Medal, some of his awards. So, you know, he, like so many of these people, had military training and probably some intelligence work he was doing. You know, that was the other thing about it. You can tell by how he was moved around that, yeah, he's probably not just your basic soldier doing that. So that'd be interesting to research more. But basically, you know, he had a military background. And when he was discharged from the Army after being wounded in 46, that's when, you know, he started his career, basically. And he started, like most people, with radio and then moved into TV. Now, one of the things about Serling's work is it's right out of that culture of critique, critical theory of emotional manipulation to sell an agenda. It's like just constantly questioning the narrative and tearing it down and tearing it down and tearing it down. And his big things were racism, censorship, and war. And so this is that Jewish idea of, you know, wars are what white people do, and the only way we can have peace is in a Pax Judaica where the Jews are in complete control. Then we'll have peace. But we won't have peace as long as Gentiles have power, because they're the ones who do wars. And so it's that double standard. You know, you everything he wrote about war was always Gentiles doing it. He never ever showed the hidden hand of the Jewish bankers like the Rothschilds and the Warburgs, who were behind the scenes creating these wars. No, it was always focused on those white Europeans and those white Americans with their wars. And that no one has the right to censor him, and that racism was wrong. Even though the Jews are the most racist people on the planet, it was that, you know, building up the black people and turning them against white people. And that's a thread that runs throughout, that empowering the black man is a theme that we see very early on, and that, you know, just challenging the pre-Civil Rights Act of, you know, 1964, when we still had segregation in the United States. And he was just a big proponent of that is so wrong. And it's because he knew that it wouldn't work. The Jews know this won't work, but that's what they want. They want that failed state. So he was always the big champion of, you know, racism, et cetera, or anti-racism. So when you look at his work, things like The Storm was on the local Cincinnati TV station in 1950. He got probably his big start with a show called Patterns on a Kraft Television Theater movie, made for TV movie. And of course, the sponsor was Kraft, which was a Jewish company. And of course, this was an attack on that white business model of American business. And, you know, just attacking every aspect of white culture, but at no point ever looking at any Jews. In 1956, he did Requiem for a Heavyweight. And then in 1959 to 1964 is when the Twilight Zone series debuted on CBS. And out of um, 156 episodes, he wrote or co-wrote 92 of those. So, you know, he's a very prolific writer. But you look at what he was writing, and it's basically that same template, you know, over and over again, just using different characters. But the themes are always the same of what you do doesn't matter. It's that nihilistic outcome. It's always a demoralizing type thing. You should feel bad about this and always follow your heart's desire. And saw a very interesting podcast today by Vox Day. And he's talking about so-called modern literature, and that it just really breaks down into those themes of, you know, individualism and nothing you do matters, that you should follow your heart, you know, forget the system, forget society, you know, you should just do what you want to do and screw everybody else, if you will. And, you know, in the bigger scheme of things, nothing you do matters. So it's that nihilism. And this really permeates Serling's work, in my opinion. In 1964, he basically redid A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, called A Carol for Another Christmas. And so here again, it's the Jews always attacking Christmas with a Christmas special. So this debuted in November of 1964 on ABC. And basically the themes are the lessons learned is that the person should give up nationalism and embrace globalism, because globalism is the way to peace. And so that was the big communist message there. And in 1964, he did the screenplay for 7 Days in May, which was a 1962 book by Fletcher Neble and Charles Bailey. I think that's right, Bailey. And that is a very interesting story that is kind of a retelling of the events that happened when there was almost a coup in the United States against the Roosevelt administration, and the whole thing with Smedley Butler and all that. That was kind of the influence of that, but also possibility of a coup in the United States during the Cold War. There was lots of rumbling about that, that, you know, during, you know, we're infiltrated with communists, we need to get them out by, you know, if we have to use military force. And so that was kind of the vibe in several circles, especially military circles in the 60s. But 7 Days in May is a very powerful movie if you've never seen it. You can actually see the entirety on YouTube. In 65, he did a series called The Loner. And again, you know, you just see these constant themes in Jewish literature of, you know, the alien, the isolated stranger. And so The Loner, you know, was a series he did. And then 69 to 73, he did a very macabre series called Night Gallery on NBC in the United States. And Night Gallery was, again, one of those using fear to push an agenda. And so when you look at all those Night Gallery episodes and around the fear involved, there's a lot of sexuality and a lot of the cultural Marxist agenda. You see all this idea of, you know, integration, et cetera, a lot of communist thought, the white guy's always the bad guy, that kind of thing. And, of course, last week we talked about the Planet of the Apes. He wrote the original screenplay for that in 68, and then they kind of redid it before they did the movie, but they used a lot of his work in that. And then in 69, he did a game show, of all things, called The Liars Club. And I always thought this was the most cynical game show ever. Basically, the premise, and I remember, after I saw the clip, I remembered this from when I was a child. But basically, you would have three contestants and four celebrity panelists. And the celebrity panelists would bring out an object or whatever and explain what it was, but only one of them was telling the truth, and the rest of them were making up a lie. And the contestants had to figure out who's telling the truth and who's lying. And when you watch it, it's just this idea that, you know, you got four celebrities, they all know the truth. One is the designated truth teller, and the other three are the liars that are trying to fool the contestants, and how good of a liar they are and how good of an actor they are, you know. And so that just kind of gets back into that war by deception, and that actors are professional liars, and these people lie as a tactic, and that they would make a game show around this, I thought was very, very cynical. It did not last long, because I guess a lot of people agreed with my sentiment that that was just a bad premise for a show. And then in 1972, he did a made-for-TV movie called The Man, and the premise here was that, and this is based on Irving Wallace's book, but James Earl Jones, a black man, was a senator who, by a series of events, ends up becoming the president of the United States. And so this is just that whole Jew pushing the black men to take over the white world. And, of course, all the white people are the bad guys in this movie, of course, and all the Jews and the black people are the good guys in this. And, you know, so you just see these constant themes running throughout his work. Now, he died in 1975 at the age of 51. So he died relatively young. When you look at here, 75, he had a minor heart attack, and then second heart attack later. And then died on the operating table. And so he was actually 50 years old. So, and you know, he was like the poster child for the coffee drinking, chain smoking Jewish writer. He and Harlan Ellison, you know, that's basically what they lived on, was cigarettes and caffeine and alcohol. You know, after he died, you know, the Twilight Zone franchise continued to be a staple. It was put into syndication. The original episodes are pretty much playing nonstop somewhere. Then in 1983, they did a Twilight Zone, the movie, and it was produced by Steven Spielberg, of, you know, yet another Jewish director who loves to lie and demonize white people and slip in as much degeneracy as he possibly can in a storyline and get past the evil censors. And, you know, we look at, you know, Spielberg's body of work, and, you know, it's like, well, it makes sense, you know. So he did the Twilight Zone, the movie. Then they did a reboot in 1985 to 89 on CBS. where they redid the series, updated it. And then again, the second reboot was in 2002 to 2003 on the UPN network. Now, and there's actually, I think, rumbling of a possible yet another reboot of The Twilight Zone, either as a movie or as a TV series. So nothing definite, but, you know, there seems to be talk of that because, you know, they just keep trying to churn out the same old things and go back to what worked because everything they're trying now doesn't work. And again, they always try to take something and modernize it to push the Overton window their way into that. You know, let's see if we can get this a little bit darker. Let's see if we can get this a little bit more degenerate. Let's normalize the abnormal a little bit more. And so when you look at Rod Serling's body of work and you look at the four stages of how to subvert a nation, the idea of demoralization, destabilization, crisis, and then the new normalization, and that whole series of events from the beginning of Hollywood up through the blacklisting days to the 1950s, the Cold War, you know, you just see this trend of coordinated, organized, highly financed Jewish interests working against the interests of the rest of the world, basically, but especially the constitutional United States. You realize that these people that were on these committees that were investigating this were not wrong. Henry Ford was not wrong. You know, Adolf Hitler was not wrong. These people are out to carry out their modern Maccabee world Zionist agenda. And part of that is white genocide. That is part of their strategy. They want us gone. And the methods they use are any means necessary. And that includes fourth generation warfare, which is, you know, a lot of that is psychological warfare. And so much of everything that's coming out of that television or on that movie screen or on that radio, it may be fascinating. It may be clever. Oh, you may like the twist ending that you didn't see coming, but there's always going to be that drop of poison in it because that's what the real agenda is. You know, the entertainment factor is just the delivery vehicle for the poison, if you will. And so when you look at the strategy of what they call revolutionary parliamentarianism, it really is a pincer plan where, you know, from above you have these experts and authority figures, people like, you know, the ADLs and the SBLCs, figureheads, the celebrities out there, the paid AIPAC puppet politician, these paid think tank people that are given a conclusion and then paid to come up with a body of data that supports that preconceived conclusion. And this pincer plan is pressure from above where the experts and authority are saying these are the problems and these are solutions. And then pressure below where you've got your masses out there, your George Soros protesters, the rent-a-ruckuses out there in the streets, given the illusion that this is what everybody wants. And so the people in the middle, the middle-class Americans, as part of that Solomon Asch group conformity groupthink, thinks, oh, well, I guess my thinking is wrong, and I need to change. I need to get with the times, because it seems that everyone around me, above and below, think this is a good idea. But you know, that is part of that communist Zionist model that they have used in every country they have taken down since they started this World Zionist movement in the late 1800s. But like I always say, it goes back to 70 AD. That war never ended to these people. And we are at a state of war. And like I always say, you know, whether you like it or not, you are at war, and these people want you dead or enslaved. It's because that fits their agenda. So, getting back to the chat room here. I don't know why that closed out. But anyway, so again, Twilight Zone was always one of those shows I loved, especially me and my mother. We always, you know, she just thought Rod Serling was the most clever writer in Hollywood. And for the longest time, I agreed with her. But then you start to see the rest of the story, as the late, great Paul Harvey would say, and, you know, realize that this was an angry Jew that really despised everything about America and wanted it destroyed because they were convinced that once the world was in the hands of the Jews, it's going to be this utopian paradise and that we're the root of all the problems. And that's what we're up against. And it's a very long-term game. We're dealing with multi-generational Maccabees here, and they're very well financed, very well organized. They have their agenda. And we're in the process of waking everybody up finally and looking at this at the global scale. For the longest time, you know, we were all separated and the Jews had their distributed network. But now, thanks to the internet especially and mass transportation, the world's gotten smaller. We Europeans are able to exchange information and say, oh, we see what they're doing. They did that to us. Yes, and this is what they did to them. And so now they're being exposed. Their real history is being exposed. And the question becomes, where do they take it from here? And we always know, you know, the Samson option's part of their agenda, but, you know, would they go through with it? And what do we do? So what is the answer to the Jewish problem at this stage of the game when they have so much control over the old established power pillars of all our societies? So with that said, thank you for joining me in the Twilight Zone construction zone, because this is what they want. They are going for this transition state where they want all the old destroyed. And we have to stand up against that, or we will never make it to the stars, as we say. But anyway, so you've been listening to Blackburn Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. Thank you all for joining me in this wacky Wednesday, and I hope everyone has a wonderful week. And until next time, I will see you all at the rendezvous.